Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is climate change. Today's episode is part of the special Transition 2021 series on the President's Inbox. In the weeks running up to Inauguration Day, I'm sitting down with experts to discuss the foreign policy challenges facing the incoming Biden administration. With me to discuss how President-elect Joe Biden will likely approach U.S. policy toward climate change are Alice Hill and Todd Stern. Alice is the David M. Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council. A lawyer by trade, she held several positions in the Obama administration, including serving as Senior Director for Resilience Policy on the staff of the National Security Council. Alice is the co-author of Building a Resilient Tomorrow, How to Prepare for the Coming Climate Disruption. She has another book due out next summer, tentatively titled No More, How We Will Energize the Fight for Climate Adaptation After COVID-19. Todd is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. From January 2009 to April 2016, he served as a special envoy for climate change at the U.S. State Department, where he led U.S. efforts to negotiate the Paris Agreement and all bilateral and multilateral climate negotiations in the years leading up to Paris. Todd also held several positions in the Clinton administration, including as the senior White House negotiator at the Kyoto and Buenos Aires climate conferences. Alice and Todd, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Jim. Glad to be here.
Thanks, Jim. Delighted to join you and Todd.
I want to discuss how a President Biden will likely approach climate change. But before we do that, I'd like to begin with your assessments of how President Trump handled the issue. Todd, if we might, since you're our guest, could I ask you to begin?
Sure. Well, from my point of view, President Trump could not have handled the issue any worse had he tried. And he did try very hard. He made it completely clear in his campaign and even before he got to the White House that he didn't believe in climate change, called it a hoax, never took it seriously. And when he got to the White House, he proceeded to approach it essentially with a wrecking ball taken to every significant domestic policy that President Obama put in place, and also announcing, I believe, at the very beginning of June of 2017, that he would take the United States out of the Paris Agreement. So a complete across-the-board rejection.
Alice, would you share that assessment?
Yes. President Trump signaled that he didn't believe in climate change, and he did all the things that Todd has described, but he also sent a message broadly throughout the federal government and to many other stakeholders that they should not work on climate change. So very early on, he removed any mention of climate change in national security strategy. It had been there before. He took it out. And then we saw slowly the removal of that term, climate change, from most strategic documents that guide operations, the missions, and strategies for our federal agencies, including FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, which is responsible for planning for climate-worsened events. So he was undercutting the efforts to cut emissions while also delaying Americans' preparation for the worsening events that are caused by climate change.
Todd, obviously, climate change has been a hot and contested issue in U.S. politics. President Trump has frequently dismissed it as a hoax. I will note, however, that if you pick up the newspaper, it's hard to avoid stories of catastrophic wildfires, bigger and more frequent storms, and more intense droughts. And I'll note that earlier this month, a UN report was released showing that greenhouse gas emissions reached a new high last year, putting the world on track for an average temperature rise approaching 3 degrees Celsius. So when you hear the argument that climate change isn't real or isn't a problem, how do you respond?
Well, look, Jim, this is just a part of a larger problem of too many people not wanting to listen to science and not wanting to listen to facts. I mean, I will say that if you look at the buy-in, the belief in climate change and the need to do something about it, that's growing very decidedly in the United States. It has become a really core issue on the Democratic side, obviously not as much on the Republican side. But if you look generationally, if you look sort of at the millennials on and younger on the the Republican side, you see increasing acceptance of the notion. You see something like 50 different college Republican groups around the country petitioning the Republican National Committee to change their position on climate change. So it is growing, obviously, for the people who say there's no climate change, despite all of the things that you just mentioned. Again, we live in a world that is distressingly marked by way too many people who instinctively don't want to listen to science, don't want to listen to facts. And of course, the leadership of the Republican Party is very damaging in this regard. There's a lot of people who don't believe climate change precisely because Democrats do believe it. And so they're really only motivated by the partisan nature of the framing.
Alice, can I ask you a similar question? I know you must give lots of talks to groups about climate change and the threat it presents. When people argue against you and say it's not real or it's not significant, how do you respond? What is the argument to persuade people who are skeptics that climate change is either real or significant?
Well, I start with what we often hear from Republicans when they say that they don't want to act on climate change, that they're not a scientist. I am not a scientist. As you've mentioned, I'm a lawyer by training, but I actually spent over a dozen years as a judge. I was before that a federal prosecutor. And in both of those jobs, you're focused on what's the evidence? Do we have sufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that someone's guilty? That's what you do when you're a criminal prosecutor. And when you're a judge, you're weighing the evidence. Judges are not experts in the field. They're expected, as we ask juries, to look at the evidence and make a decision. I had the opportunity very early on in the Obama administration to speak with the scientists across the federal government, as well as in some of our leading research institutions, talk with them about what they were learning. As I say, I'm not a scientist, but we have to judge evidence in the courtroom that's scientific when we're not scientists. It's happening across the United States every day. In fact, it's happening in cases where the very highest penalty we have, the death penalty, is imposed. And we're asking non-scientists to weigh that evidence and make a decision. So similarly here, that's what we do. And the evidence is in, I can say as a former judge, it's beyond a reasonable doubt that the climate is changing. It's now changing at a very rapid pace and that it's human caused. So to the extent people want to argue with that, I just have to say, take a look with me with the evidence and still hold true. It's a question of, in my experience, whether they've really had an opportunity to sit down and look through. It's a complex issue, and almost no Americans have had any formal education in this. Even our students today in colleges and universities, it's a very small percentage who have any kind of training in what climate change means, why it occurs, and what's expected.
Alice, I take your point that climate disruption is not something that will happen in the future, but it is something that is happening today. And when we talk about climate change and dealing with it, I hear two different words tossed around, and I'd like you to help me understand what they mean. One is to talk about mitigation. The other one is to talk about adaptation. What does each mean? They sound kind of similar, but my sense is they mean very different things and excite different passions or different reactions.
Well, you pointed out a very important issue here. First of all, the vocabulary is confusing. We use mitigation primarily for cutting emissions. And what we have is the accumulation of greenhouse gas emissions, and it's a slow accumulation, and that causes a great deal of warming over decades. So importantly, if we cut our emissions tomorrow, if we mitigated our emissions to zero, we would still have warming. So we need to deal with the warming, and that's where adaptation comes in. Adaptation is how do you plan for, adjust to the impacts of a warming climate? And those impacts are, just as you mentioned, worsened droughts, extreme rainfall events, a rain bomb, extreme heat events. And we talk about an average temperature, 3 degrees. That doesn't sound so big, but the way these impacts come in, they're localized and it's not an average. Some places are hurt more and some places have different kinds of impacts. The confusing vocabulary comes from the fact that we also use the word mitigation. In addition to cutting emissions, we use mitigation to talk about cutting risk. And that's actually the vocabulary that FEMA, our emergency managers, use. They say mitigate risk. And if you're just entering the field of climate change, it can get really confusing very quickly. But there are two major buckets of action here. One is to cut the emissions, and that is probably the most important to avoid the very worst impacts of climate change. But the other is we now need to prepare for and address the impacts we're already experiencing and the worsening impacts we'll experience even if we're very successful in cutting our emissions.
Todd, I'd like to talk a little bit about what candidate Joe Biden said he was going to do about climate change. I think, as you pointed out, climate change has become a major issue for Democrats. One of the big issues on the campaign trail was whether Joe Biden would endorse a Green New Deal or not. He said he had not endorsed the Green New Deal, but he did put forward a number of initiatives, ambitious initiatives, as I understand it, to deal with climate change. Can you give us sort of the big picture on how candidate Biden was thinking about approaching this issue?
Sure. A number of key initiatives or key guideposts that he articulated in his campaign. So first is that the United States reach net zero emissions by 2050. So it's very important, and it's a kind of watchword all around the world right now. With
what does that actually mean, net zero emissions?
It means that we would get too close to actual zero emissions, but you balance the gases that are actually emitted as compared to the greenhouse gases that are sucked up. They can be sucked up in a natural way by trees and plants and so forth. There's also potentially other ways to do it. There's such a thing as carbon capture and storage technology, which is being worked on. So there's different ways to basically absorb emissions as opposed to release them in the first place. So the balance between those two, that's where the net comes in. But mostly to get to net zero, you've got to cut emissions an enormous amount, pretty close to zero. So that's one thing. Second thing that Biden called for is to reach a completely clean power system. It's a utilities system, 100% clean by 2035. It's highly ambitious. Third aspect is to put a big emphasis on environmental justice. Some 40% of intended investment that President-elect talked about going into distressed communities. And he talked about a $2 trillion investment package that he hoped to move forward in the context of both recovery and making that recovery green and climate friendly. So in addition to those goals, you need to see the Biden approach as basically a combination of standards and investments, which is different from some places. The EU, for example, does have standards also, but they have a big focus on carbon pricing through their version of the old cap and trade system that, you know, that President Obama tried to enact, but unsuccessfully back in 2009 and 10. But so the president-elect is focused on standards for all sorts of things, for power plants, for cars, for appliances, for all manner of activities that create emissions, and investment. So that's where the $2 trillion or whatever portion of the $2 trillion he's able to get once he's president.
Alice, I don't know if you have anything you want to add to Todd's description of Biden's campaign pledge on climate change, but I would like you to help us understand to what extent what candidate Biden was saying about climate change differed from this idea of a Green New Deal. And I ask because my sense is, talking to many of my Republican friends, the notion of a Green New Deal raised hackles. So if you give me some sense of the differences, I think that'd be helpful.
Yes. Well, the Green New Deal was proposed. And if you actually read the proposal, it is a grab bag of ideas. And some of those are not included in President-elect Biden's plan that he has publicized and even what he's discussed in his campaign rallies. It was a collection, the Green New Deal's collection of ideas. I think the value that it has shown is that it coalesced thinking about climate, and it certainly has taken off as a term that's used worldwide. Others have adopted some version of that term. So it brought value in that it focused on the critical crisis posed by climate change. But the actual elements of it, some are picked up, but the vast majority, I'd say, are not in the very detailed plan that the Biden-Harris team have put forward that talk about research and development and the goals that Todd has laid forward, also much more specifics about rejoining the Green Climate fund, which was came out of the Paris Agreement that Todd negotiated, work in the Arctic, much more comprehensive and focused really on what the federal government can do. The Green New Deal was a much broader vision. And frankly, some of the things that were included were surprising for a person who works in climate from my perspective. And I wrote an editorial about this at the time, that it's the concept that is the value add that I saw at the time versus the document specifics.
I think one other thing to bear in mind with respect to the President-elect's program is that this is very heavily focused on and framed as an economic and job-creating program. There is a quite deliberate focus on climate change not being seen simply as a siloed-off issue that maybe you agree, maybe you don't. There's very good reason for the kind of focus that the President-elect is talking about, because emissions come from basically everything having to do with the use of energy. So it covers the entire economy, and the sort of change that he is looking for is meant to spur economic growth, spur job creation. And it's an approach which, by the way, is being taken in other parts of the world too. You can see the very similar kind of emphasis in the EU, for example.
Todd, that provides a nice segue into talking about what it is the Biden administration is going to do. And I'm reminded that when we talk about presidents, there's what they say they will do, there's what they want to do, and then there's what they get to do. And I really want to focus on that last piece, because during the campaign, the Democratic hope was that they would end up controlling both houses in the new Congress. But unless we have surprising upsets in the two Georgia Senate races set to be held on January 5th, that's not likely to happen. A President Biden is going to face a Senate controlled by Republicans. Even if the conventional wisdom on Georgia is wrong, Democratic control of the Senate will be by a knife's edge, making it hard to move forward with truly ambitious proposals. And you were talking about a proposal that's measured in the trillions of dollars. So how much can a Biden administration actually get done with that political constraint?
I actually think quite a bit. I will pause for 1 second to say that I don't quite agree that it's such a long shot in Georgia, but we don't know what's going to happen for sure. And it certainly might leave us with a...
I'm just here to repeat conventional wisdom, Tom.
Yeah, exactly. But look, I think that a President Biden will be able to do quite a bit. There are a lot of actions that he can take on the basis of existing authority. That includes regulation and progress in the power sector toward that goal that I already mentioned. That includes standards with respect to cars, action with respect to the building sector, which I think would be driven both by the awesome procurement power that the federal government has, including both military and non-military, as well as the energy efficiency standards that have been working in the system for years, which were cranked up significantly during the Obama years and can be cranked up more to affect basically every kind of appliance that takes up energy in buildings. And buildings are one of the biggest sources of emissions. Methane standards. So a whole lot of things can be done on the basis of existing legislative authority. There are also things that I think that President Biden will be able to do even without a majority in the Senate that are legislative. There are things like tax credits for renewable energy, which have been in some ways a perennial, but can be cranked up more. I think that there would certainly be a possibility to get a green infrastructure bill. I mean, even if we only have 48 Democrats, that's just two senators away from getting legislation passed. There's, I think, a possibility with respect to increased R&D. There's no question that it will not be as robust as he could do if he's got 50 Democratic senators, but there will be a lot that he will be able to do one way or another.
Alice, what are you looking forward to as the most important two or three things that a Biden administration can get done, let's say in the first 2 years in office?
Well, clearly, rejoining the Paris Agreement is very important. And then following that up with some serious commitments on behalf of the United States to demonstrate that we are serious about taking care of business here at home in terms of cutting our emissions. I think that beyond cutting emissions, I hope that the new team will look at the continuing impacts to the United States and how we can better prepare. We do not have building codes that are up to snuff when it comes to resilience to climate impacts, nor do we have zoning laws that keep us safe. We just simply don't have enough information available to homeowners, to renters, to understand their risk, or to communities to appreciate what's ahead and what that could mean for their most important investment, their home, typically. Finally, I think that with the appointment of John Kerry Kerry as the special envoy, we will see an increased emphasis on national security and climate change. We really have seen that in abeyance for the last 4 years. When I was in the Obama administration, I led the development of an executive order on that issue. There was unanimous agreement at that time among the security agencies of the need to focus on national security and climate change. I think this is well recognized by the Europeans, the Japanese, across the globe, that when you're talking about these types of impacts, it profoundly undermines human security, the availability of water, shelter, food. And once that's gone, you will see many millions of people on the move. In fact, we've already seen increasing migration as a result of climate change. Most directly for the United States, I think we already see people on their way north after hurricanes Eta and Iota in Central America. Those two devastating hurricanes have left hundreds of thousands of people homeless, and they will go in seek of a better life, particularly since that area of Central America is so troubled by violence and gang-related activity. So we need to think through how we can better support countries as they absorb these impacts to keep people at home and keep them safe so that they don't want to migrate and really contribute to global instability.
I will note, Alice, that you mentioned the hurricanes Eta and Iota, which is itself indicative of the frequency of storms, because we typically don't get into Greek letter names to be able to name storms the way we did this year. But I want to turn to you, Todd, because Alice mentioned John Kerry, former Secretary of State, and he's been designated to be the special climate envoy for the Biden administration. You did a long tour of duty as a special envoy for the State Department. What can a special envoy get done?
So I'm going to get to that in a half a second. I just want to reiterate that John Kerry is one of an all-star team of people who President-elect Biden has already named. So that includes Gina McCarthy to be essentially the domestic czar within the White House. It includes Brian Deese, who will be the head of the National Economic Council, who I worked with closely in 2015 in pursuit of the Paris Agreement. Even Janet Yellen at Treasury is a strong supporter of climate change, Pete Buttigieg at transportation. So it's an all-star team, and it signifies the genuine commitment. This isn't just for show. This is a complete commitment by the president-elect, which I think is great. Now, special envoy can do a lot, and I think Kerry can do a lot. He will be a very special envoy. But the diplomatic mission is entirely different now than it was when I was there. And it's important to understand that in terms of your question. The diplomatic mission fundamentally, when I got to the administration at the very beginning in 2009, was to negotiate international agreements. We started in 2009. We went by some fits and starts along the way, but got on the track toward Paris and then ultimately succeeded in getting the Paris deal done. That was the mission at the time. We needed an international regime that all countries would be a part of, because you can't solve this quintessentially global problem without that. At the same time, we have that now. And what needs to be done now is for countries around the world to take the transformational steps in their own economies at speed and at scale that can allow us to meet the really awesome and difficult goals of the Paris Agreement that we're facing now. And so I think that John Kerry's mission is going to be oriented around that, oriented around working probably in the first instance with the biggest players, with the EU, who's really a leader right now in what they have done and what they are doing toward those goals, in working with China and working with the other major players, and then, you know, smaller countries as well. But the mission has got to be now to implement Paris, to reach that net zero, and to hold global temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius, an incredibly difficult target, but a target which we actually need to meet by 2050, is going to just take a tremendous amount of action in to stop building coal plants, to retire coal plants that exist, to shift to electric cars, and on and on and on. The use of renewable energy and the ending of fossil fuel subsidies, a big effort to reorient the international capital flows to be in alignment with what we need to do on climate change. There are a ton of things that are going to be on Secretary Kerry's plate as a special envoy, just not negotiating a new agreement. That's done. Now we basically have to do the things to implement that agreement.
Todd, I want to pick up on your point that John Kerry is going to have a full agenda, a full plate of things to do as envoy, and really focus on one issue in particular. You mentioned China. You also mentioned coal plants. China recently announced that it is going to seek to be carbon neutral by, I believe it's 2060. However, China also appears to be proceeding with its very ambitious plan to build lots of coal-fired power plants, not just in China, but in other countries. Do you think Secretary Kerry will be able to persuade the Chinese that that policy of building lots of coal-fired plants is impractical and counterproductive? Or is it going to be caught up in a whole separate issue, which is tensions between the United States as they sort of contest power and influence, not just in Asia, but around the globe more broadly?
So I think a two-part answer to that question. We had a very important climate relationship with China during the Obama years. The overall relationship with China was not easy then, but it's gotten to be a lot worse. It has deteriorated, and that's something that is a perception pretty much across our political spectrum, from liberal Democrats to conservative Republicans. So it is built in more difficult. At the same time, you cannot deal with international climate change without engaging China. So we will also have to do that. Kerry is not going to be able to single-handedly go in and persuade China to do exactly what you're talking about, and which is really the most important thing with respect to China. The announcement by Xi Jinping, their president, of his pledge to go carbon neutral, essentially net zero before 2060, is hugely important, big surprise. But as you say, if you look at what their plans are in this decade, 2020s, they are so far have not indicated any intention to drive their emissions down. And they have indicated every intention to build a lot of coal, both at home and on their Belt and Road initiative. So those things don't square. It's going to be incredibly important to push China toward much more aggressive climate action in the 2020s, including curtailing coal and not only not building new, but retiring coal that they have. And I think that it's not going to be easy at all. I think there's going to need to be some combination of persuasion, pressure, and leverage. And that can come from certainly the U.S. to some extent bilaterally. But the U.S. is going to have to marshal our allies, our traditional allies, but also allies that were progressive developing countries that came to be known during the Paris talks as the High Ambition Coalition. They are highly attuned to the need for what's called climate ambition, doing a lot. And so they can be a powerful voice with respect to a player like China as well. Then there's also elements of leverage of the kind that the EU is talking about, which is border adjustment tariffs with respect to exports from countries essentially that aren't doing enough on climate. This is something that Biden is interested in as well. It is quite a technically challenging exercise to sync up two different systems as like the EU and the US. The EU relying more on carbon pricing, the US not relying on that in all likelihood, because it's not really feasible politically. But that's the EU and the US will be working closely together to try to overcome the technical hurdles to doing that. And I think that that is another form of pressure that can potentially be brought to bear on China. But China is going to need to, the fact that Xi Jinping went as far as he did on the 2060 pledge also gives me some sense of optimism that their system needs a little bit of time to adjust to that. I think people were probably caught by surprise within China. And so some of what needs to be done to meet that pledge has not been absorbed into the system yet. I would hope that we will see earlier peaking of their emissions, a movement away from coal and so forth. But there will need to be a lot of pressure. And I actually think that will probably be job one for Kerry.
Alice, to this point, we've been focusing on what the federal government can do, what the White House can do directly. But there's also the question of what state and local governments can do, and perhaps just as important, what the private sector can do. And I will note that a lot of insurance companies and companies that insure, insurance companies, so-called reinsurers, are greatly worried about the costs of insurance given climate-induced disasters. At the same time, earlier this month, 30 of the world's largest asset managers, companies like Fidelity, Schroders, UBS Asset Management, companies that oversee something like $9 trillion in assets, has set a goal of achieving a net zero carbon emissions across their investment portfolios by 2050. What are the sort of things that the Biden administration could do to increase encourage more of that kind of local, state, and private sector activity?
Well, the first thing in terms of the financial markets is to regulate disclosure of climate risk. We've seen that playbook through France was a leader in this instance. Canada has fallen suit. New Zealand has just announced it will require disclosure. And there are two types of disclosure that are very important. One is the transition risk. What's it going to mean as we move away from fossil fuels to clean energy in terms of the value of certain companies and the value of holdings of asset managers, insurance companies, these reinsurers hold billions of dollars in assets. What's it mean as we move away from fossil fuels? But a second issue, which has really been highlighted by the pandemic, I think, is what does climate risk mean to operations of these businesses? And will they be able to successfully continue in a world with worsening disasters? That's an open question mark. We really don't have deep understanding of how our supply chains will be affected. We saw with COVID that suddenly masks, ventilators, other things weren't available. Sometimes foods not available. So we see spikes in food prices. We need to be thinking through how we will continue commerce in a changed environment and one that's rapidly changing. So regulation would force those issues to come to the fore. We've had a number of voluntary efforts just in the past week or so. The Fed has joined the Federal Reserve, an international effort to get to greater understanding of climate risk. But we need to compare apples to apples. It's Mayor Bloomberg put it clearly, the markets can't operate unless we understand this risk, and we need to have a common platform for disclosure. It's quite complex to accomplish it, and some countries have moved on to say, in addition to disclosure, we're going to have stress testing. So that will cause some major market adjustments, in my opinion. I think the markets are currently discounting the climate risk, the risk from these impacts.
What is stress testing? What would that entail?
Well, that looks across their entire portfolios, and they look at if we did this during after the 2008, that was something that we started looking at. How can we handle these types of stress events? And it's forcing companies in the financial sector, banks, to look at what will happen if, for example, we have a major crisis in the real estate markets, if once we realize that sea level rises here and these homes that have a 30-year mortgage on them, in 30 years, they may well be too soggy or completely underwater to be of any value. And unlike the 2008 financial crisis, people stayed in their homes because they wanted to keep their credit, they liked the home, and they paid even though their mortgage was underwater. The home was worth less than what was owed on the mortgage. That I don't think will happen here because these houses will be uninhabitable. People won't stay in these very soggy homes. And what does that mean for a real estate market once we actually start incorporating that risk in our decision making? We see pockets of this occurring, but really only at the margins. And we see companies like Zillow coming out and saying, wow, there are just billions of dollars at risk and we're not quite registering it. Many things the Biden-Harris team could do to improve the understanding of risk so that we would have a much smoother transition going forward.
For my last question, I'd like to ask both of you to look forward and really tell me where you think we will be on climate change in a year. Do you think that the Biden administration will have made significant progress in terms of regulation and laws enacting its plans for mitigating and adapting to climate change? Are you concerned that they're going to be frustrated coming out of the box because of an inability to bring Congress along or because they're going to be opposed in the courts? Is something else likely to happen? Where do you come out on that, Todd?
I think that in 1 year that the president-elect will have done a lot on the domestic front. I think in much less than a year. I think that because he's got, as I said before, a significant array of existing authorities, he will come right out of the box taking strong action. I think he is fully bought into the notion of the goals and the very significant goals that we have facing us, and he's gonna seek to act on that. that right away. And I think certainly on the parts that he can do with existing authority, he's just going to, I think, move very quickly. And again, I expect that there'll be some things that can be done legislatively. And if the Democrats win two seats in Georgia, then some very large things that can be done. Internationally, I think that it is a very big year because there is an annual climate conference. They're known as the COP, the Conference of the Parties. So this is COP26 now. It's supposed to be the one that was supposed to happen this year. It's postponed because of COVID. So it'll be in November in Glasgow. It's hosted by the UK. And that's the first time when the five-year cycle built into the Paris Agreement for countries to re-up and enhance, ratchet up what they have agreed to do. This is the first time that period comes up. So it's that five-year period. And given that we are not on track yet, you've referred to somebody saying that we are closer to a track of 3 degrees than 2 degrees, much less 1.5. That's no surprise, by the way, coming out of Paris. Nobody thought we were going to be right on track right away. The point was set the goals, make a start, and then ratchet up every 5 years. So here's that first five-year period. And there is more intensity with respect to this period than we even would have thought back in Paris, because essentially the consensus understanding of what we need to do is different from what it was 5 years ago, owing to some very important landmark scientific reports that came out in 2018, as well as what we've seen around us. So a goal that was intended to be originally less than two is now again moved much more toward 1.5. Both of those numbers were incorporated in Paris, but it just accentuates the degree of focus and concern about COP26 producing significant enhancements with respect to what countries are going to do right now in the 2020s. We talked about China in this regard earlier. So I'm hopeful that there will be some significant movement and that COP will be a success. But whether we get that kind of movement, most of all by China, the US, and the EU, and we're getting it from the EU, I think we'll get it from the US, so China is the biggest unknown. That's really going to determine, I think, more than anything, whether that COP is a success. And I don't know what I would bet. I certainly hope that it will pass that mark.
Alice, what about you? Where do you see us a year from now?
Well, I agree with Todd. The Biden-Harris team has an aggressive agenda. They've set forth a lot of ideas about how they want to cut emissions, lead internationally, build resilience, make sure that there's a social justice consideration in all of this decision-making. And they've even called out that they want to attend to those who will lose their jobs as a result of the move away from fossil fuels. So it's ambitious, bold, and very important for right now. But there are headwinds. And among those headwinds is some of the work that was previously done has now been tied up in courts. Unraveling the Trump actions could take some time. It's not going to be just, oh, we'll pull it all back. We'll have to follow certain administrative regulatory procedures. Similarly, I think we're going to see more impacts in the United States, which combined with what's happening in the state governments already, their ability to be healthy in post-pandemic world is challenging. And so as we ask them to step up and do more, I think it will be difficult domestically. And then we will see climate affecting communities in ways, as we've seen in 2020, actually. We'll probably have the most billion-dollar events we've ever had just this year. Most of those are climate worsened. And you have a crisis beginning to brew in California, for example, of whether homeowners insurance will be available in wildfire areas. So all of that will be challenging the ability to keep focused on this current agenda, not to mention all the other issues of recovery from the pandemic, the social justice and racial equality issues we have. So I hope that Americans can recognize what's at stake for us in terms of addressing this challenge. These changes from climate change are permanent. We can't deacidify the ocean easily. We can't turn down the thermostat once we have the kind of heating that we're anticipating. And I'll just say the last thing, these reinsurers who insure the insurance companies, some of them have publicly stated, if we get to 3 or 4 degrees, we can't insure. And if they can't insure, that means that insurance companies can't insure, and that means it's only only the government left, and that is a big pull on our ability to live in the way that we've enjoyed in the past. So, critical moment. The plan is a good one, and I very much hope that the Biden-Harris team succeeds because there is a lot at stake here.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Alice Hill, David M. Rubenstein, Senior Fellow for Energy and the Environment at the Council, and Todd Stern, non-resident Senior Fellow at Brookings and a former Special Envoy for Climate Change in the Obama administration. Alice and Todd, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe was also a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Dr. Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.